This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Early this morning, Israeli troops surrounded a warehouse where Mohammed Sidra, an alleged Islamic Jihad fugitive, was residing. The Israeli Defense Minister, Shaul Mofaz, said Sidra posed an immediate danger. The troops killed two boys, aged 3 and 13, last December in a failed assassination attempt on Sidra. The ongoing Israeli raids are seen as a provocation by the militants, who declared a three-month truce on June 29th. Hamas has argued that the terms of their ceasefire permit them to avenge the killings of activists by Israeli troops. Earlier this week, we spoke to Nicole Gawet, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Jerusalem. We discussed the mood in the West Bank in light of two car bombings this week in retaliation of Israeli raids in Gaza and the targeting of Palestinian leaders. We continue our conversation today and ask Gawet to respond to reports by Reuters that ambulances responding to emergencies have been held at checkpoints so long that several Palestinians have actually died waiting on lines at checkpoints.
Well, access to health care has become, it's an issue of renewed concern. It was a very serious problem throughout the first year and a half, 2 years of the Intifada, because the Israelis charged that ambulances were being used to move weapons around and therefore would not let them through checkpoints or would hold them up indefinitely as people inside were suffering, often as women were in labor. Now a lot of the healthcare access problems are being sparked by the building of Israel's separation barrier in the northern West Bank. It's making movement very difficult between cities, and healthcare facilities, good ones, are far and few between. There's one in a city called Qalqilia, which is surrounded on all sides, apart from one 8-meter entrance and exit, and another in a very tiny village that's also surrounded on three sides, basically walled in. And people in the communities around these hospitals, around these cities, are having trouble getting to them because of checkpoints, because of the barriers being put up by the wall's construction and the wall itself. So it's, another sad complication from this conflict.
Nicole, you're there on the ground reporting from Jerusalem. Are there issues that or observations that you've had that I haven't asked you about directly that you think are particularly germane to our discussion that you'd like to share with us now?
I think it'll be very interesting to see how the shootings today affect the wall's progress, the barrier's progress. One of the most contentious issues surrounding the barrier is its route. And the Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, had promised the Americans that he would hold off on a central section of the barrier, which in maps that have been published, it shows the barrier diving right into the West Bank and encircling a few settlements, among them Ariel, where one of the attacks occurred. It'll be interesting to see whether the Israelis use the attack as justification for continuing with that route. Israelis are very in favor of the wall, but Palestinians are against because of its effect on the humanitarian situation, but also because it is taking up a lot of Palestinian land in the course of its detours into the West Bank, just around settlements.
Can you just describe for us what the walls look like to our listeners that may not be familiar?
Israelis and Palestinians use different words for it. Israelis call it a fence, and the Palestinians call it a wall, and it really is neither and both. It ranges from 50 or 30 to 100 meters wide. It starts with if you were moving from the Palestinian side to the Israeli side, you would first encounter a pyramid of coiled razor wire and then a ditch of about 6 to 8 feet deep. That's followed by a sort of a patrol road area, an electrified fence, another patrol road area, some sand that is smooth so that soldiers could see the imprint of any footprints if someone did try and get over the fence. There's another pyramid of razor wire. Along the course of the barrier, there are observation cameras as well as sniper towers that will be manned. So it's quite an immense undertaking. It is the largest infrastructure project going on in Israel right now. Around certain parts of the West Bank, the city of Qalqilia, for instance, it's not an electrified fence, but a huge concrete wall, 8 meters. So I suppose that would be close to 50 feet in height. Mm-hmm. It's quite foreboding and claustrophobic feeling, especially when you remember that Qalqilia is surrounded on all sides.
And so the plan is on the part of Israel to continue the route into the West Bank.
Well, so far, right now, because the Americans raised concerns about the barrier's route so far into the West Bank, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has said that he will delay work on that section and that they would consider the route and perhaps compromise. But he's made it clear to his domestic constituency that nothing will change. It'll be interesting to see how that develops. The Palestinian objection and the American concern is that as the barrier's route is projected now, it doesn't leave much space for a viable Palestinian state. It cuts the West Bank up into three sausages, if you will. There's a sort of a northern section, a middle section, and then a southern section. They're not contiguous, and they're shaped so that urban expansion is going to be very difficult. Movement, which is the basis of, a healthy economy, is not going to be very easy, and a lot of prime agricultural land will be lost.
The Palestinians are desiring that their state be the West Bank, or how?
The West Bank, which is 22% of what they call historic Palestine and Gaza. Mm-hmm. That's what they are expecting and hoping for. The projected barrier route that is being seen now, it would encompass about 65% or so of the West Bank, so it's considerably smaller than the Palestinians hoped for. Mm. It's not just size, it's potential. The wall hugs the major cities very tightly, so it's hard for people to move in and out. It makes moving from one point to another very difficult, and it cuts off both the northern and southern West Bank from Jerusalem, which is a contested city, but it is the hub of the West Bank, and to isolate the rest of the Palestinian areas from Jerusalem is to short-circuit any sort of development, political, cultural, economic, that it might have.
So it sounds like the Israelis have carved out the best of the West Bank to suit Israeli purposes.
Well, from maps based on Ministry of Defense comments and contractor information and map that settlements have put out, it certainly looks that way. We'll have to see what happens.
Nicole Gawet, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking with us from Jerusalem. One of the main selling points of the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq was the assertion that Iraq was reconstituting its nuclear weapons program and that Iraq's weapons of mass destruction posed an imminent threat to the U.S. To bolster that assertion, allegations were made that Iraq had attempted to purchase uranium from the West African country of Niger. In 2002, when these allegations first surfaced, Vice President Dick Cheney's office expressed concern, and Joseph C. Wilson was sent to investigate. Wilson is a former American ambassador to Gabon and had also been the last American to speak to Saddam Hussein before the first Gulf War. He spent 8 days moving around Central Africa, attempting to track down information about uranium mining in Niger and the control systems put in place to prevent theft and misappropriation of potentially fissile material. In his own words, Wilson said, given the structure of the consortiums that operated the mines, it would be exceedingly difficult for Niger to transfer uranium to Iraq. Wilson was interviewed recently by Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles about the administration's progress in Iraq in establishing its stated goal of liberating the Iraqi people and establishing a democracy.
Well, I think the first phase of the reconstruction and occupation has gone very badly. I think we missed some really important benchmarks early on that would have reassured the Iraqi people that we, in fact, had a vision of constructing a better future with them. Specifically, it was absolutely vital that we provide security, personal security to the Iraqi population so that they could walk around their cities free of fear that they're going to be murdered, raped, robbed, and have their cars carjacked. That hasn't been done even now. Secondly, I think it was important that we provide the Iraqis with a comfort level that would have enabled them to feel more positive about the future that they face. We haven't done that. And we haven't restored electricity. We haven't provided the sort of adequate level of medical services, a rapid enough response to some of the needs of fresh water and sanitation and garbage pickup and things like that. So we're already at a deficit as we go into this. All those needs are absolutely critical to be satisfied if you hope to move to the president's vision of a prospering democracy in Iraq. And democratization is tough business, and we need to get it right.
You have said that before, that democracy, of course, is not an easy thing to just bring to another country, especially in a country like Iraq. The Iraqis are undoubtedly happy that Saddam Hussein is gone, but they're increasingly frustrated with the U.S. occupation, and obviously for the reasons that you just mentioned, but also there is reason to believe that Iraqis just don't want a foreign power in their country, occupying the country. What do you think the United States should have done, and what do you think is going to happen at this point?
Well, I've always said that despite the understandable hatred on the part of the Iraqi population for Saddam Hussein, we should have recognized that that was not going to translate into affection for a conquering power. Iraq is a country that has been conquered several times in its long history, and it has homegrown conquerors throughout its history as well. And the idea that somehow the Iraqis were going to be cheering us from the rooftops, even if it had happened, it was only going to be a 3 or 4 day phenomenon, and then the Iraqis were going to want to know where do we go from here. I think it's hard to say what we should have done because we've done it. Anybody can second guess, and I've certainly been one of those who have second guessed. But the important thing is where do we go from here? And I think that we need to share the risk more broadly by inviting the international community to come in and participate. It would give it additional legitimacy, and it would reassure the Iraqis that, in fact, we're not occupiers, but we're part of an international effort to reconstruct the country. And secondly, I think we need to bring in a lot more money a lot more quickly, and we have to be prepared to stay there for a long time.
You've said that the path to peace lies not through Baghdad, but rather through Israel. Can you talk a little bit about how you see Middle East politics and the role, especially, of some kind of a peace process in the Israeli occupied territories and in Israel proper, how all of that plays into the larger politics and also Bush's attempts to put out this sort of so-called roadmap for peace? Does it even come close to what you have said?
Well, I think the United States has a long historic friendship and strategic alliance with Israel, including being the guarantors of Israeli national security. And that is a burden which we accept, I think, willingly. It is also a responsibility. It poses for us a responsibility to be active in the Middle East peace process. And what I have said is that I was saddened to see the Bush administration really not play a very active role in the first 2 years. Or as Mr. Berger said in a recent speech, it took 600 Israeli deaths and 2,000 Palestinian deaths for the United States to become reengaged. Now, my own sense of this is that for the modernization of the Arab world, you have to pull the thorn out of the side, that is the Arab-Israeli peace process. Arab countries have been able to ignore the legitimate responsibilities of governance in their own societies by essentially blaming the Israelis and the Palestinians for all their problems. And so we need to solve that problem in order to free Arab governments or force Arab governments to deal with issues within their own societies. Now, my sense on this, and I recall an article that was written by Brent Scowcroft not long ago in which he said that it would be important to devote the same amount of energy and attention to restarting the peace process and committing ourselves to the peace process as we had devoted to getting Resolution 1441 passed. I interpret that as meaning that we need a high-level delegation present in the region at all times. My experience of having done peace negotiations in the Angolan Civil War, for example, has led me to conclude that episodic appearances are not good enough. That one of the things that one does in diplomacy is occupy space and time between belligerents or antagonists so that essentially you can help them act on their fondest dreams, hopes, and aspirations instead of on their worst nightmares. And left to their own devices, antagonists and belligerents have a tendency to fear and act on those fears more than they hope and act on those hopes.
If the U.S. has such a close relationship with Israel, as is very obvious it does, would you think that the United States should hold some of that leverage that it has with Iraq, you should use some of that leverage with Israel, and, say, threaten to withhold some military aid until they stop building illegal settlements on Palestinian lands or until they stop building the so-called security fence, which I believe Bush is actually talking about right now? Should the United States not be using its leverage with Israel?
Well, I believe the United States should be using its leverage with both parties. There is no doubt that the Second Intifada has been an absolute disaster for the Middle East peace process. I think the absence of the United States from that process for the past 2 years has been unfortunate and has not helped both sides achieve the security and peace arrangements that they need. Now, I also think that the United States enjoys a privileged position in its relationship with Israel, and it is the indispensable partner. Therefore, it is incumbent upon the United States to use every arrow in its quiver to ensure that we do, in fact, pull the thorn from the side of the Middle East that is this process. Now, the specific tactics that the administration might employ are certainly the administration's to do. But I think fundamentally, more generally, what I would continue to advocate would be for a much larger role and continuous role rather than episodic role on the part of U.S. diplomacy and U.S. policymakers.
Israel, of course, is the recipient of huge weapons from the United States, weapons sales as well as aid. And we talk a lot about weapons of mass destruction in the media today. Many of us use this term. What is your sense of the fact that the United States today seems to be one of the largest producers of weapons of mass destruction? We are talking, you know, constantly about using small nuclear weapons, deploying them, preemptive war, etc. And we have the largest weapons arsenal in the entire world. We have more weapons at our use. And even though some might say that the United States is, you know, more responsible than other nations, we have clearly used them. We've, in this particular case with Iraq, violated the sanctity of this responsibility. Do you see the hypocrisy? Can you talk about that?
Well, first of all, we did not use weapons of mass destruction in this campaign on Iraq. So there may have been other things that we did which people may criticize, but the weapons of mass destruction, which was the premise of your question, was not in fact used. Weapons of mass destruction were used to bring the Second World War to a close with Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And we do have large stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, most of which have been left over from the Cold War. We have reached some agreements to destroy some of those weapons of mass destruction. I think everybody would like us to live in such a peaceful world that we didn't need to be able to defend ourselves with this particular arsenal, and perhaps we'll get there someday. But we should be under no illusions that this is not a peace and love world. There are a lot of tough actors out there, and we have a lot of potential adversaries, and we have a need to maintain a strong defense. What we need to do to augment that strong defense, is, in my judgment, is we need to have a we need to once again embrace the doctrine of collective security, embrace the doctrine of political and diplomatic leadership in our relations with the rest of the world, and attempt to find the way ahead collectively. This administration, in my judgment, has turned the notion of collective security on its head without having any ideas on how to replace it, other than to turn the responsibility for security over to American military forces. That is not sufficient. The military is only one part of our national security apparatus, and it's the other parts that need to be strengthened and need to be brought into play. We should not rely strictly on the military.
You are clearly critical of the Bush administration, but what do you think of its role then with North Korea? Now, here we have a country where it was clearly to the advantage of North Korea to put out the fact that it was creating weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons, that it was testing them. And in fact, that did serve to protect North Korea from the United States, at least on the surface. It seems as though one has to proliferate weapons of mass destruction in order to protect oneself from the United States.
Well, clearly, when the president gave his speech on the axis of evil, the other State of the Union address, in the run-up to the war to Iraq, the lessons that both Iran and North Korea took away from that exercise was that they needed to have a deterrence against the United States, perhaps turning against them. My own judgment on this, and I've said this repeatedly, is that weapons of mass destruction pose the most serious threat to our national security over the next decade or two, and it's a threat we need to take seriously, and it's something that we need to deal with all of the tools in our tool belt, including diplomacy, bilateral and multilateral, sanctions when necessary, political will when necessary, and if necessary, resort to military action. I've never discounted the possibility of a need for military action on any of this. I was very struck the other day when former Secretary of Defense Perry, who knows far more about this issue than most Americans, came out and said that there is a real threat that North Korea will not only have nuclear weapons but may actually explode them in an American city. That is a real wake-up call that we need to address it.
Joseph C. Wilson, former ambassador to Gabon, Africa. He was dispatched by Vice President Dick Cheney to investigate allegations of Iraq attempting to purchase uranium from Niger, Africa. He was speaking with Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles.
May I be peaceful and happy. May I be healthy and strong. May I be free from fear. May I be filled with loving kindness. May you be peaceful and happy. May you be healthy and strong. May you be free from fear. May you be filled with loving kindness. May presidents and prime ministers, dictators and despots be peaceful and happy. May they be healthy and strong. May presidents and prime ministers, dictators and despots be free from fear. May they be filled with loving kindness.
Flowers grow in my room. I am watering them. I hear a loud explosion.
The smoke of human tragedy fills my lungs.
From the burning crosses
the smoke
in Mississippi
from
and
the burning
Alabama.
Crosses in Mississippi and Alabama. The smoke of Hiroshima, Johannesburg, Auschwitz,
and Wounded Knee.
And Wounded Knee.
Of lies,
the smoke
broken
of lies,
racism,
broken treaties,
and hate.
Racism and hate.
What is the difference between a soldier and a murderer? What is the difference between a terrorist and a murderer? What is the difference between a terrorist and a soldier? How can you tell the difference?
How can you tell the difference?
Tell the difference.
How? How can you tell the difference?
Please.
Please.
Send tears.
Send
to put out
tears
the fire of
to put
death.
Out the fire
please
of death.
Send tears to
please send tears to put out the fire of death. May the fire of compassion rain on all human beings now and forever.
David Budbill, We Want to Live, from his album Songs from a Suffering World. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Chauffard. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donation to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.
We want to live.